This is Orson Welles, speaking from London.
To keep you in suspense.
Tired of the everyday grind.
Night transmissions.
Well, it's Sunday night, 10 o'clock, and time for night transmission. This is our second show, and maybe I should take a moment to try to explain what's going on here. What's going on is audio. There are going to be a lot of old radio shows played. In fact, mostly it's going to be old radio shows. We're going to concentrate on science fiction and fantasy, horror, and supernatural stories. There'll be a good deal of suspense-type stories. In fact, one of the programs that we'll be going to pretty often is called Suspense. Now, I'm not going to pretend that I have any real expertise or background in radio. And so for the most part, I'm just going to try to stay out of the way. My motivation for doing this show is that I love these old radio shows, and I thought that maybe five or six of you would. So, here we go. Sometimes, like tonight, I'll have a little information for you about the radio show we're about to listen to. For example, tonight, we're going to start off with an Inner Sanctum mystery from March 29th of 1948 called Lady Killer. Here it comes.
Good evening, friends of the creaking door. This is your host to welcome you into the Inner Sanctum. Come in, come on in. Well, let me tell you about the loot we picked up in our family. Mother got a new broom. Yeah, she needed it ever since she wrecked the old one in a forced landing on the roof last month. Uncle William got a fur-lined straitjacket. And dear, darling little Aunt Matilda got a new hat pin. Yes, her last one got stuck in the skull of her fourth husband. All right. Turn your lights low and your radio up. And remember that all the actors getting killed on this program are being well paid for it. The winter winds moaned around the gabled house like a wandering band of wailing women. As Caroline Giles, puzzled and frightened by something she's seen in the gathering dusk, makes her way into the living room. This is young Mrs. Giles' first night at the family mansion built by her husband's grandfather. Only this morning, the attractive bride arrived after a honeymoon trip in Europe. When she enters the huge, shadow-filled room, she notices the servant girl at the window. She's a young girl, the only other person in the house. And Caroline can see that she's scarcely able to control the terror she feels.
Mary?
Yes, ma'am.
What's going on out there?
Nothing. When will Mr. Giles be home?
He should be here within an hour. Why are those cars stopping out there?
Cars, Mrs. Giles?
Really, Mary, you must see them as well as I do. Three of them stopped within a few minutes. Look, there's another one.
Maybe that's Mr. Giles.
No, the car isn't coming into the driveway. It's stopping outside. Who are these people, Mary?
I don't know.
Why should they stop outside? What did they want?
I don't know.
Oh, Mary, you don't know. There's no reason to come still.
Mrs. Giles, come away from the window.
But why?
You don't know them. Oh, please come away from the window.
Mary, why? Now,
I warned you. They're throwing rocks through the window. Get down, Mrs. Giles. Get down on the floor. You'll be hurt.
But Mary...
Oh, please. Mrs. Giles, just pray that they don't come in here. Just pray that they don't.
Wait a minute, Mary. I hear sirens. It's the police.
Oh, the police. Oh, thank heavens. They'll make them go away.
Mrs. Giles, I'm Richard Croydon, the mayor of this town. I'm sorry we had to come here under these circumstances.
How do you do?
This is John Dent, our local chief of police.
Mrs. Giles, I'm very sorry about what happened tonight. Crowd is gone now. I'll do my best to see that it never happens again.
I've also come to offer what apologies I can. Must have been a frightful experience for you on your first day here. Our people may appear civilized enough, but in many ways we're a very primitive community. I suppose your husband told you that.
No, he didn't. But David told me about you, Mr. Croydon. He said you were the oldest friend he has. I believe you live down the road?
Yes, yes, that's right. That's how I happened to see those cars coming, and I phoned Chief Dent.
But why did those cars come, Mr. Croydon?
Why?
Well, yes. Why should those people who hardly know me do a thing like this?
Well, didn't David tell you?
Tell me what?
Where is David now?
He went to town. I expect him any minute.
Well, perhaps he'll tell you what you want to know when he returns.
Why can't you tell me?
I'm not sure that I care to.
Mr. Dent, perhaps you'll be kind enough to explain this.
Them people weren't after you, ma'am. They were after the man you married.
David? What?
Dent, if Mr. Giles hasn't told her, I don't think it's your place to do so.
Well, the woman has a right to know. The reason them folks are trying to kill Mr. Giles is because they think he's a murderer. Some call him even worse than that.
What do you mean?
Mrs. Giles, 2 years ago, a series of killings began in this here county. Girls, young girls, four of them were found on lonely roads, stabbed to death. Homicidal maniac, that's what the state police officer said.
And my husband?
Well, your husband was arrested for them crimes. He was tried right here, but they let him go. We didn't have enough evidence.
David, I can't believe it. Why should they suspect him?
Well, he knew one of them girls, and, he had been sent away, ma'am.
Sent away? What are you talking about?
Well, everyone knew there was something wrong with him. He had to go to an asylum for a while.
That's quite enough, Dan. Mrs. Giles, I must tell you this. David was discharged from the rest home, completely cured. It was nothing more than a nervous breakdown. Dent, you have no right to frighten her like this.
I'm not frightened. And I'm very grateful to Mr. Dent for telling me what he did. I just want to know one thing. My husband was acquitted. Why should they still believe he's guilty?
Because since he left town 6 months ago, there ain't been none of these murders. Not a single one. Now that he's back, they'll start again.
That's what you believe, Mr. Dent?
Oh, no, ma'am, but that's what the folks are saying.
Thank you. And now, if you don't mind, I'd like to be alone.
Well, Mrs. Giles, if there's anything I can
do... No, thank you. There's nothing. Good night, Mr. Croydon.
Good night. Come along, then.
Good night, ma'am.
Good night. Hello? Operator, will you give me the number of the railroad station, please? No. Never mind, operator. Don't bother.
Are you going to leave, Carolyn?
David, you heard?
Yes. And I heard everything else my very old friend, Mr. Dent, told you. I was behind the other door.
Then why didn't you come in?
Why ruin their fun? Besides, I was curious to see just what your reaction would be.
David, why did they have to tell me? Why couldn't you?
Do you think this was an easy thing to tell to a newly married bride?
I would have found out sooner or later.
I did plan to tell you, Carolyn, in due time. That's why I ordered Mary not to say anything.
Darling, it isn't true. This is all an insane dream, a nightmare.
No, Carolyn, it's not a dream, but in many ways it is a nightmare. Were you going to run away from me, Carolyn? Is that why you phoned the station?
Yes.
Carolyn, if you want to leave me, I can't blame you. I realize it may be asking a little too much of any woman to be my wife and to live here.
Why did you come back here, Dave?
Because I want to prove to them that I'm not what they think I am. And I was hoping you'd help me. I thought maybe you loved me enough for that. Carolyn, I'm terribly sorry it must end this way.
I'm not going to leave, David.
Carolyn, I hope you understand what you're saying. You may be risking your life by remaining here.
I love you, David. I'll risk it.
I want you to be certain. Because in the end, I may fail and be put to death.
To death?
Yes, there are going to be other murders.
Other murders?
Don't ask me how I know this, but I'm almost positive that sometime tonight, a girl, in or near this community will be killed. Brutally stabbed to death. I'll have to go out tonight and see if I can prevent it. You still want to remain?
Why are you telling me this?
Because I want to know if you really love me or if you said what you did to placate a madman. To quiet a homicidal maniac who may still murder you. Are you going to stay, Carolyn?
Yes. I'm going to stay, David.
Now, just try to calm down.
I saw them. I saw them. Now, Mary. Philip.
Try to pull yourself together. Tell me what you saw.
There was a man out there. A man moving around.
Are you sure of it, Mary? I don't see anyone.
Well, maybe you can't see him from here, but I saw him from the window of my room.
All right. Let's look out the window of your room.
I don't want you to think I'm seeing things. I'm not the kind of girl who sees things.
I didn't say you were, Mary, but I... Well, I don't notice anything unusual from your window either.
You don't see anything?
Just the lawn, the tree. Mary, I know we've all been under strain today. I guess we're a little jumpy, aren't we?
I guess so. But I wish Mr. Giles were here. I don't like us two being alone.
I know, Mary. But it can't be helped. Now come, dear, I think you'd better go back to bed.
But I'm afraid to be alone in here. They can get in through the window.
Then we'll close the shutters.
Help me, Mary. All right, ma'am.
There we are. The outside doors are all closed.
Yes, I locked them myself, but... Well, still, this is a very old house. They can get in.
Well, there's a lock on your door that works quite well. You can lock the door from the inside, and then you'll be as safe as you can possibly be.
All right. I'll do that when you go.
Very well, Mary. I'll go back to my room. I'm sure you'll sleep now. Good night.
I hope so. Good night, Mrs. Giles.
Did you lock the door, Mary?
Yes, I just did. I'm turning out the light now. I'm sorry I troubled you, Mrs. Giles.
Good night.
Good night. Oh, she's right. I must be hearing things. Mrs. Giles! There's someone in here!
Story of married bliss. I mean bliss. You know, if Caroline had only listened to this program, she'd have realized that it's always a mistake to marry a man who has a weakness for murdering the domestic help. It not only makes house cleaning difficult, but creates a terrible servant problem. That there is one compensation in marrying a homicidal maniac. When you'd call your mate crazy, you'd be so right. Well, let's get on with our story. As you remember, Caroline couldn't break into Mary's room, and now she rushes to the telephone and dials the operator.
Hello? Get me the police. Hurry, please. Hello? This is Mrs. Caroline Giles. Will you please send someone right away? I think there's been a murder.
Hang up, Caroline. Hang up that phone. What's the matter with you? Why didn't you do as I told you? I don't want the police to know about this until we're ready.
That room. We just came out of Mary's room.
Yes, I saw her.
Thor, you were in there all the time. You were locked in the room with her. You killed her.
Caroline.
You murdered her. They're right about you. You murdered her.
Caroline, you're hysterical. Stop it now. Stop. Sorry I had to do that. Now you must get a grip on yourself.
Yes, David, I'll be all right. I'm all right now. How did you get into her room?
I heard screams when I parked the car. The window to her room was open and I climbed through. I saw her on the bed and then I unlocked the door and came in here.
You found the window open?
Mm.
But I locked it myself. I bolted the shutters.
Well, it's open now. When did you bolt the window?
A little while ago. The murderer must have been in the room hiding, but she locked herself in.
I guess he escaped through the window.
Yes. Perhaps that's what happened.
You still think I killed her?
I don't know what to think anymore. The way you came from her room.
I explained that.
Yes, I suppose you did.
Carolyn, now listen to me. If I killed her, do you think I'd be talking to you now? Here, look.
Son.
If I'd murdered Mary, the next step would be to kill you. And you see how easy it is for me to do it. Now, Carolyn, you believed in me before. I'm asking you to believe in me again. I don't want the police to know I left this house tonight. Dent's like the rest of them. He hates me. He'd be glad to accuse me of this crime. Now, Carolyn, I want you to say I was home all night with you.
And if I don't?
I've got this gun, Carolyn. If you let me down, nothing much will matter then. Now, that might be the police, Carolyn. I'm going to open the door.
Good evening, Mr. Giles.
Good evening, Dent.
You got here quickly. Maybe that's because I was kind of expecting to come.
Oh, have you been watching my house?
I ain't saying. When I got that radio call, I didn't lose any time. Oh, Mrs. Giles, you phoned in something about a murder?
Yes, our girl, Mary, she's in there.
Mr. Giles,
are you accusing me of this too, Dent?
It's mighty funny, right here in your own home.
This time, I can easily prove that I had nothing to do with it. My wife and I were together all night.
Is this right, Mrs. Giles?
That's right, Mr. Dent.
Hello, David.
Come in.
I understand that Dent questioned you again this morning.
Yes, but he didn't get anywhere. I think even he's beginning to get the idea that I'm not a murderer.
I see.
Oh, Carolyn, dear.
Oh, hello there. David, why didn't you warn me your friend was coming tonight?
Well, I phoned Richard only a few minutes ago. You see, Carolyn, I have to go out.
Go out?
Yeah. I didn't want to leave you alone after everything that's happened.
I know, but... Well, couldn't we come with you, David?
No, afraid not.
Why not?
Well, it might be dangerous.
David, where are you going?
I'm sorry, dear, but I can't tell you. It won't be a long trip. It's only about 20 miles or so. That's all the information I can give you.
Has this something to do with these murders?
Perhaps.
Now, David, I wouldn't advise you to take matters into your own hands.
I'm afraid I have to, Richard. You see, the police haven't gotten very far, and my life is at stake.
Your life?
Isn't it obvious? The people are stirred up about these crimes. Who can tell when one of them may take it into his head to murder me? It's becoming a matter of the killer's life or my own. Furthermore, there's another reason why I must solve this. A reason I can't divulge right now.
Why not?
Darling, please don't ask me. I think that after tonight, all this will be over. Bye, Richard. Goodbye, Carolyn.
Bye. Richard?
Yes?
What did he mean by another reason?
Well, Carolyn, if he's right about the murderer, then the next logical victim will be a girl, an attractive girl who's very close to him. So that people will suspect him even more. And the most likely person is yourself.
Did he tell you how long we'd stay away, Richard?
No, he didn't. Shall I deal another round? That must be David.
Hello? David, are you all right, darling? Well, when will you be home? All right, I'll tell Richard. Goodbye. David's on his way home. He'll be here in an hour.
Where did he call from?
A town called Waverly. He says he knows who the killer is.
That's impossible.
How do you know?
Because if he knew, he'd never have made that call.
I don't understand.
It was a perfect signal to the murderer.
murderer.
He told him that he was safe. That he had all the time he needs. The full hour.
Richard. No.
Please. I must warn you not to do anything foolish. It will only make matters worse for yourself.
What do you have in your hand?
A knife. You see, I simply press this button and it snaps open. Try to control yourself, Carolyn. Don't try to fight the inevitable. Take my advice and submit to what will come. It will be less painful.
Help me.
You see how futile it is to struggle. I have the knife at your throat now. I have only to move my arm, and it's all over.
Why don't you? Why are you waiting?
There's no rush. For once, I have a little time.
Time?
Time seems to extend the experience. I must warn you not to scream. The moment you do, it will all come to an end, suddenly, violently. Screams are dangerous. One can never tell who hears them.
Take the knife away.
No.
Please.
Fear seems to do something to your features, Carolyn. You look extraordinarily beautiful. And I must compliment you on your self-control. You still haven't even raised your voice.
You can't get away with this, Richard. David will come home and find you.
That's not quite how it will happen. David will come home and find you. I shall have the rare pleasure of seeing his reaction. And then it will be his turn.
Going to kill him?
Yes, it will be a new experience. I've never murdered a man before.
It can't possibly work. You'll be caught.
I plan to be. But I shall plead self-defense. Everyone will believe me because I'll tell them he murdered you. It's very difficult not to scream, isn't it, Carolyn?
They won't believe you. They'll never believe you.
Oh, yes, they will. My police commissioner hates David because he was freed after Dent arrested him. And his position also depends upon me. Oh, I admire you, Carolyn. None of the others held out this long. You must almost be insane with fear and terror, aren't you? And yet...
I won't scream, Richard. I won't.
In the end, you will.
I won't.
You must.
I won't.
Really are extraordinary, Carolyn.
I won't. Ah! Help me, someone help!
Carolyn.
I don't understand. You were here.
Almost all evening. I phoned from a neighbor's house to make him force his hand. I got back just in time.
Still alive?
Yes. Richard.
David, did you know? You couldn't have been that clever.
I suspected you, Richard, but I wasn't certain till tonight.
It was a trap. And Carolyn the bait. Or a trick.
I'm afraid that's what it was, Richard. Why did you make them think it was me?
Why? Because you were a Giles. Always a little too clever. Never quite one of us. But you'll die for this, David. You'll be blamed for this and the other murders. I've left letters accusing you of the crimes. And Dent will believe them. Even over your wife's testimony. You die for this. They'll kill you.
He's dead.
David, is it true what he said about the letters?
Probably. Dent will never believe me.
Good evening, Mr. Giles.
Dent.
Yeah. Been out there all night. When I heard the shots, I came running in. So you killed him?
Yes, but I had to, Dent. He was going to murder my wife.
That's true. He's the homicidal maniac you've been looking for. You've got to believe that, Mr. Dent.
Of course I believe it, ma'am. I've been suspecting him for a long time. Ever since he spread them stories to folks about Mr. Giles. I heard what he said before he died. You've got nothing to fear now, Mrs. Giles. You and your husband can live here and we'll be proud to have you. And some folks will be mighty ashamed about what they've been saying and doing. And I reckon I'd better call in, get them to take this man away.
Ha, 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 ha. bet you thought David was crazy, but he fooled you, didn't he? As the squirrel said to the walnut tree, you're still not as nutty as people. And that brings us to the moral of this story, which is taken from a retired witch who once said,
why slice your husband's head off when it's so easy to nag him to death?
Oh, here's a little thought to take to bed. Never murder your enemies, because then you'll have no one to hate but yourself.
Well, so much for the lady killers, huh? This is going to be far from a musical show, but because I go through these radio shows and cut out most of the commercials, and by the way, if you do hear a commercial, please be aware that it represents no sort of underwriting arrangement between this show and this station and those products or services. But I'll just leave them in there to enhance the historical perspective for everybody. Sometimes because of the absence of these commercials, I have a little extra time on my hands. Sometimes more than a little, several minutes. So one way to fill the time and round the show up to 2 hours is to insert music. It seems to me that the logical thing to do is to stick with period music. So, as much as I might enjoy Babes with Axes, and I do, or the Beatles, and I do, you're unlikely to hear them here. You'll be far more likely to hear Glenn Miller, Artie Shaw, Billy May, those kind of people. This song that I'm about to play is just for fun. It's Spike Jones, and was recorded in 1942. Sit back and listen to, well, maybe I should say lay back and listen to Deaf Outer Space.
When the Führer says, we is the master race, we heil, heil, right in the Führer space. Not to love the Führer is a great disgrace, so we heil, heil, right in the Führer space. When Herr Goebbels says, we own the world in space, we heil, heil, right in Herr Goebbels space. When Herr Göring says, they'll never bomb this place, we heil, heil, right in Herr Göring's face. Are we not the Superman? Aryan pure Superman.
Yeah, we is the Superman.
Super duper Superman.
Is this Nazi land so good? Would you leave it if you could?
Yeah, this Nazi land is good. We would leave it if we could.
We bring the world new order. Heil Hitler's world new order.
Everyone of foreign race will love the Führer's face
when we bring to the world disorder. When the Führer says, we is the master race, we heil, heil, right in the Führer's space. Not to love the Führer is a great disgrace, so we heil, heil, right in the Führer's space. When the Führer says,
He is the master race. We hire. Right in the Fuhrer's face. Not to love the Fuhrer is a great disgrace. So be Heil. Heil. Right in the Fuhrer's face.
We're not going to just play American radio programs. In fact, we have two programs tonight from Britain. The first one is from the Black Museum, which was produced by the BBC in 1951 and based on Scotland Yard's collection of murder weapons and various ordinary objects associated with historical true crime cases. The show made its way onto American radio via the Mutual Network in 1952. Tonight's episode is The Bloodstained Brickbat, and it's based on a 1935 murder case. The word brickbat refers to a piece of brick, especially a piece that has been used as a weapon.
This is Orson Welles, speaking from London. The Black Museum. Here in the grim stone structure on the Thames, which houses Scotland Yard, is a warehouse of homicide. A museum of everyday objects. Cigarette boxes, appointment books, a hat rack. All are touched by murder. Now here's a brickbat. Coarse-grained, rough-edged, familiar. Perhaps your own home is built of bricks, exactly like this one. In this case, however, no home was built by such a brick. Rather, a home was destroyed by it. Destroyed forever.
It's still such a normal-looking object, Inspector.
Is it really? With that broken corner? With the stains still on its edges?
I suppose you're right, sir. If there's one thing that can upset normalcy, it's spilt blood.
And today, that blood-stained brickbat can be seen. Here in the Black Museum.
From the annals of the Criminal Investigation Department of the London Police, we bring you the dramatic stories of the crimes recorded by the objects in Scotland Yard's Gallery of Death, the Black Museum.
Here we are in the Black Museum, Scotland Yard's museum of murder. Yes, here lies death. Upon these tables, within these cabinets, the files of death, labeled with day and date and name of victim. Here's a hat rack. Odd to find such a commonplace object here, perhaps, but observe. Here where the wood curves from base to shaft, three brownish stains. Blood dripped here. From a weapon concealed within the lining of an overcoat. Three stains. Which placed a murderer at the scene of crime. Broken alibi. That's another story. Here's our brickbat. Of such bricks are garden walls built. Later the ivy or some such creeping vine grows over them, hiding the sharp edges, softening the four square contours. This brick, too, was meant for such bucolic purposes. But as it happened, things didn't work out that way. We might say it all began when young Anne Friskin composed an advertisement and told her much older husband, James, about it.
So you're placing an advertisement. Wanted, boy, about 18. References, handyman work. Some such thing?
Exactly, dear.
Oh, very good. Only don't let him get too close to Alma. It might not be good for
her. A simple domestic scene. Wife cooperating with husband, or the other way around, if you prefer. Some small mention of the husband's cousin who stays with them. That's all. The advertisement appears in the usual help wanted columns. Several young men apply. One is Dick Terry.
Yes, ma'am, I've had some experience during the summer at my uncle's place in Dorset.
And the money's all right?
Oh, quite generous, ma'am. What with the room over the garage and all.
Well, your references seem quite good. And a good school report, too.
boy settled into his job and worked out well. The gravel driveway was soon in good condition. The lawns were well mowed. The bricks were ordered for the repair job on the garden wall. Yes, the bricks were ordered. And in the household, all was well and quite normal.
One more hand, ladies?
If you wish, James.
Aren't you satisfied with beating us again, dear?
I suppose I should be. But it must be somewhat dull for you, Anne, dear, night after night with just Alma and me.
In the household, as we've said, all was well and quite normal. Undercurrents? If you look for them, perhaps otherwise a retired, well-to-do gentleman in a suburban London home, living quite happily with his lovely young wife and his cousin Alma. Still, one never knows, does one?
Good morning, Dick.
Oh, hello.
Oh, the work is coming well, isn't it?
Yes. Lovely day, isn't it?
Nothing quite like the springs we get here, is there?
Awfully quiet there. Yeah.
Yes, I suppose it is. For someone your age.
Begging your pardon, Mum, it don't seem to me like you'd be giving up just yet.
Oh, thank you, Dick. It's nice of you to say so. Aren't you getting those bricks a trifle uneven, Dick?
Ah, that's on purpose, Mum. It's a trick I learned from my uncle. It gives the creepers and vines and such a better hold.
It's clever. You do know your work, don't you?
I hope so, Mum. A person likes to do his work where he's appreciated.
Well, you are. No fear about that. And just to prove it, come up to the house, Lathan. We'll see about finding you a nice cold drink. On a warm day like this, a cold drink would...
No, after all, it's quite natural, isn't it? You'd do as much for your help, wouldn't you? No one would think anything of it. No one did in the Friskin household either until these trips for the long, cool drinks became somewhat habitual, at which point Alma spoke to Anne.
Do you really think you're doing the proper thing, Anne? Of course, it's none of my business, I suppose, but...
What are you driving at?
That boy.
He's an excellent worker.
People will talk.
About what, pray?
Oh, nothing. But people will talk about nothing, you know. And if James should hear from the wrong person...
But please be explicit, Alma. I don't happen to have a devious mind.
It's quite simple. James is past middle age. You're young, vital. The boy is undeniably attractive with that flaming hair and all. And he is up here at the house quite a good deal.
And you're suggesting...
No, of course not. I am merely pointing out to you how it can look to the neighbors.
Frankly, I don't care. Please don't bring the subject up again, Alma. I refuse to discuss it with you.
Alma did not bring up the subject again, not with Anne. However, she waited for an opportunity, and then...
James.
Yes, Alma?
I want to talk to you.
Aren't we rather formal today? Closed doors and all that sort of thing?
I'm not speaking behind anyone's back. I've already taken this up with Anne.
Oh? What's the trouble?
It's that boy, Dick Terry.
Dick? Alma, don't tell me he's been making advances.
That's not funny, James.
Oh. Sorry. What then?
Anne is letting him spend too much time at the house. His place is in the garden and the garage. People will talk.
Aren't you doing a bit of talking yourself, Alma?
I'm doing my duty as I see it.
Then you've mistaken your duty. I'm fully capable of protecting my honor, as you doubtless would call it. And I'll thank you, Alma, not to bring this up again. Although, doubtless, you have the best intentions in the world.
Very well, James. But if anything does occur, you'll thank me for warning you.
Yes, Alma awaited her opportunity and spoke to James. That worthy and decent gentleman dismissed the incident from his mind. That should have been the end of it. Unfortunately, however, the whole matter was reopened. And in quite a different quarter.
Good morning, Dick.
Morning, Mum.
Oh, the hedge does look nice.
Thank you, Mum.
Is anything wrong, Dick?
Matter of fact, I'm giving notice.
Why, Dick? But why?
I'm giving notice.
But what's wrong? Have I done something? Or is it about your money? Because if so, I'll speak to Mr. Friskin at once.
Don't bother, Mum. I'm leaving. Call it wanderlust. Call it anything you like.
Dick. Dick, look at me. Oh, do stop clipping that hedge and look at me.
Yes, Mum?
I insist on knowing what's wrong. I thought you were happy here. I know I've been happy to have you here.
I'd rather not... All right, Mum, but... You asked for it.
I asked for what?
It's you, Mum. I'm crazy seeing you day in and day out and having you nice to me. Just nice to me and thinking of you with him and me not having a ghost of a chance. I can't stand it, Mum, that's all. You'll have to let me go.
Poor Dick. You've held this inside you all this time.
Yes.
Oh, Dick, I'm so sorry. So terribly sorry. Come here.
Fire in the garden, flash fire in dry grass on a warm summer morning, perhaps in any case. The boy stayed on his job and nothing further was said in the household. Everything was routine, quite normal. Even the bridge games in the evening, three-handed bridge, of course. July moved on into August. Hot, muggy August nights.
Well, I'm going up to bed. Coming in?
Not just yet, dear. I think I'll read a while. It may be cooler in the library. Good night, dear.
Good night, then. Good night, Alma.
Good night.
A hot, muggy August night. Dark. No moon. Barely a breath of air. James tossed restlessly. Sleeplessly.
Anne? That you, Anne? Coming to bed, dear?
No! No! Go! Go! Ah!
Well, today, that brickbat can be seen here in the Black Museum. It was Anne's screams which brought Alma and then some of the neighbors. James was not dead, but nearly so. The doctor, Dr. Kinder was his name, examined his patient and proceeded quite efficiently via the telephone.
That's right. The ambulance at once with oxygen equipment. I want the operating theater ready. Anesthetist, nurses, and my assistant. Friskin has a badly fractured skull, and with his heart condition, he has about 1 chance in 100 to live. Hurry. I'll wait for the ambulance.
Oh, no.
Now, the police.
Police?
Well, really, ladies, a man is attacked, half murdered in his bed with a heavy instrument of some kind, and you question my calling the police.
Oh, if only I'd gone upstairs with him. If only I'd gone upstairs.
If you had.
Operator, ring through to the police, please. Hurry.
Oh, to walk in like that, to find him there, the blood. Oh, his poor head. He's
breathing that awful gasp.
This is Dr. Kinder. Let me speak to the superintendent, please.
Dick. Where's Dick?
Yes. Where's Dick?
No one had missed the boy until Anne thought of him. With all the excitement, all the horror, no one had realized he was missing. Dr. Kinder finished talking to the superintendent of police and turned back to the two women.
Dick. The superintendent is sending an Inspector Ralph. Very good man, he says. CID.
CID?
Criminal Investigation Division.
Oh.
Did I hear you mention someone named Dick?
Yes, Dick Terry. He's the hired man. Well, more of a boy than a man. He has a room over the garage.
And he isn't in the house? He hasn't been here?
No. The neighbors came, but not Dick.
Perhaps I'd better fetch him.
No, stay here. The police will find him.
The police will find him.
They did find him, but in his room over the garage.
Where was he, Sergeant?
In the attic, Inspector. Hiding in a corner.
All right, son, speak up. Why?
I got scared. That's it, scared.
What of?
I heard Anne, Mrs. Friskin screaming, and I ran over from the garage, and when I got up to the room where the lights were on, Miss Galpin was carrying on, and Mrs. Friskin was just standing there screaming, and he was on the bed, and I just ran.
You didn't offer to help. Why not?
I couldn't think. Nothing.
Why?
I guess I didn't want to be blamed for doing it.
Well, who would blame you?
Somebody. Anybody.
Did you do it?
No. I never touched him. Never.
All right, Sergeant. Hold him in the kitchen.
All right, sir.
I'll talk to the Galpin woman now. What is she, a companion or something?
Cousin of the victim, sir. Lives here.
All right, send her in.
Alma Galpin knew nothing except the discovery of her cousin in the bedroom. But the inspector was curious.
The hired boy says he was scared. Have you any idea why?
Well, he's been making sheep's eyes at my cousin's wife.
Oh?
People were talking. He's a good-looking boy. She's so much younger than poor James. You know how an ignorant mind works sometimes.
The inspector knew. Also, he was a considerate man. He implied as much to Anne Friskin.
I know you've had a terrible shock tonight, Mrs. Friskin, but I have to ask you a few questions.
Of course, Inspector. I'll try to answer.
Did your husband have any enemies? Anyone who might want him out of the way?
Oh, no. No one. Everyone liked James.
Even the boy, Dick Terry?
Dick? Oh, no. No, you don't think that Dick...
I don't know yet, but we'll have to hold him, Mrs. Friskin. He seems to have something of a motive. At least, there seems to have been some talk.
They held Dick Terry on an open charge pending developments at the hospital. There, James Friskin hung on the fringe of death, barely breathing, completely unconscious. At the house, Alma faced Anne.
The police. What do they know?
I don't understand.
They're holding the boy. They're not even looking for the weapon. And meanwhile, whoever did it could be miles away.
Then you don't think Dick did it?
It's too pat. Of course not. Why would he? Even... You never gave him any encouragement, did you,
Alma?
Did you?
You're hysterical.
I know exactly what I'm saying. And I don't believe that boy raised a finger against James.
Then why did he hide?
Wouldn't you, in his position? The police, arrest, the most obvious person. That's all they know. Someone ought to teach them their business. Obviously, they don't...
Well, there are those who would like to teach the police their business. Quite a few people would. Alma Galpin set out to try. And it was with that idea in mind that she appeared in Inspector Ralph's office at the local station house.
Well, Miss Galpin, sit down, won't you?
Thank you.
What can I do for you?
How far have you got in this case, Inspector?
We're still holding the boy. The only charge at the moment is assault. If your cousin dies, well, that'll be another matter.
Then you've done nothing.
For the moment.
I see. I brought you this.
No?
Why don't you open it?
As you wish. Yes, I see. A brickbat. With stains on it.
Don't you want to have it checked for fingerprints?
Rough surfaces like this don't hold prints. Why?
It's the weapon.
Oh? How do you know?
I found it. It was in the little pile of leftover bricks at the foot of the garden. James was going to ask the boy to build a barbecue pit with them.
I see. How do you know so surely this is the weapon?
That's blood on it, isn't it?
It might be.
Aren't you going to have it tested?
Probably. Miss Galpin, do you realize that this brick might be the piece of evidence to hang that boy?
It might be. It might hang someone else, too.
Is this a charge, Miss Galpin?
Who stands to gain most? Who would have her freedom? Who would get James' money? Have you thought of that, Inspector? Who wanted the brick wall repaired? Who spent altogether too much time in the garden? Have you given any thought to these questions, Inspector?
Perhaps the inspector had. Others had, that was certain. And suddenly, with one sentence, Dr. Kinder changed the entire complexion of the case.
I'm sorry to have to tell you, Mrs. Friskin, but your husband passed away about 10 minutes ago without ever regaining consciousness.
Now it was murder. And Anne Friskin, the young widow, came to the station house to see Dick Terry in his cell.
Here, ma'am. You have 10 minutes.
Yes. Thank you.
I'll be back in 10 minutes.
Oh, Dick.
I didn't do it, dear. I'm stuck for it, but I didn't do it.
Oh, Dick, you don't think for one minute I believe you did do it.
How should I know what you believe?
Well, you know me better than that. I want to help you.
I know you better. Do I? Do I know any more about you than you know about me?
Oh, Dick, don't talk like that. Please, please let me help you.
With what, a axe or blade?
I'll get you a lawyer. I have money now. I'll take care of
you. Sure. You've got money now. You've got it all now, and I've got a murder charge. Anything you may say will be taken down in writing and may be used in evidence against you.
After what you told me in the garden.
Oh, forget it. Maybe that never happened. Maybe I was really crazy. Maybe you figured more than I meant. Well, what's the difference? He's dead and you've got everything.
You keep saying that. I've got everything.
Well, haven't you? Isn't it what you wanted?
Oh. You think I did it?
Oh, do I? All I know is I didn't, but I'm stuck in this rotten jail. I won't peach on you if that's what you're worried about. Not unless my own neck can't be saved any other way. Oh, maybe you did, maybe you didn't.
Not a very pleasant scene. Not a very pleasant circumstance. The young woman, the boy, the sadly tender phrases of a summer morning shattered between them. However, in the offices on the floor above Dick Terry's cell, Inspector Ralph and Sergeant Hopkins were more interested in facts than in phrases.
So pathology reports it's Friskin's blood type on that brick. It's the weapon, all right. But who used it?
The boy had a crush on the wife.
Badly enough to kill for her? Oh, I doubt it.
There aren't any alibis, sir.
That's the trouble. He says he went to bed as usual. No one saw him anywhere that night. The Galpin woman says she went to bed. The widow says she read for a while, went upstairs and found her husband.
Could all three of them been in it together, sir?
How do you figure that, Sergeant?
Well, Mrs. Friskin could have promised Galpin money, and Mrs. Friskin would have had the boy. They might have planned to have the boy actually do it.
Come in.
I'm sorry, Inspector.
Not at all, Mrs. Friskin. Come in. Sit down. I believe you know Sergeant Hopkins.
Yes. I have very little to say. It might be easier standing.
As you wish, ma'am.
I just saw Dick downstairs.
Too bad about him. He seemed a nice lad.
Yes, sir. Inspector, this is not the easiest thing for a woman.
I understand. You have an alibi for the boy. And yourself?
Yes. Yes, I do.
The inspector was an understanding gentleman. He offered no comment. He merely recorded a fact and let Anne Friskin leave his office with her own thoughts for company. Later that same day, he arrived with Sergeant Hopkins in tow at the Friskin house.
Ladies, we've done some further checking and investigation. We thought we'd apprise you of the situation.
I see.
Thank you for that, at least.
We're letting the boy go. He's in the clear.
I knew that all along. I told you so.
Yes, you did. I remember. The day you brought me the brickbat.
Where did you find it?
In the pile at the foot of the garden.
I see that you know Mrs. Friskin. There is no pile of bricks at the garden. It happens to be in the rear yard, near the back door, close to the foot of the back stairs. The stairs which reach the second floor quite close to the door of your room, Miss Galpin. Now, Sergeant, if you'll stay quite close to Miss Galpin and take down what she has to say.
Taken down and may be used as evidence.
Yes, the usual warning. Well, Miss Galpin, why did you kill your cousin, Miss Galpin?
She had everything. Even the boy with his sheep's eyes. I had nothing. I thought if I got rid of James, who was too dull to care, she'd be blamed. After her, I'm next of kin. I'd have everything. I saw the little pile of bricks. I meant to put them in the garden later. A brick is heavy. It hits hard!
Today, the brick pad can be seen here in the Black Museum.
Orson Welles will be back with you in just a moment.
They put Alma Galpin safely away, where she could harm neither others nor herself. Dick Terry left that pleasant suburb of London and dropped into the anonymity one can find only in a great city, Anne Friskin sold the house and went far from London to start over, perhaps, but to carry with her always the memory of tragedy on a hot, muggy night. And the memory of a mistake made through loneliness and mistaken kindness. Now, until we meet next time, in the same place, for another story about the Black Museum, I remain, as always, obediently yours.
Everything on this show is going to be an old radio show. In fact, for the next 7 minutes, we're going to listen to a recording from the Lieberbox Project.
This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. That's LibriVox.org. Recorded by me, Glenn Hallstrom, also known as Smokestack Jones. SmokestackJones@gmail.com. You'll also find my blog at TooMuchJohnson.blogspot.com. The Terrible Old Man by H.P. Lovecraft. It was the design of Angelo Ricci and Joe Sasnack and Manuel Silva to call on the Terrible Old Man. This old man dwells all alone in a very ancient house on Water Street near the sea, and is reputed to be both exceedingly rich and exceedingly feeble, which forms a situation very attractive to men of the profession of Messrs. Ricci, Sasnack, and Silva, for that profession was nothing less dignified than robbery. The inhabitants of Kingsport say and think many things about the Terrible Old Man, which generally keep him safe from the attention of gentlemen like Mr. Ricci and his colleagues, despite the almost certain fact that he hides a fortune of indefinite magnitude somewhere about his musty and venerable abode. He is, in truth, a very strange person, believed to have been a captain of East India clipper ships in his day, so that no one can remember when he was young, and so taciturn that few knew his real name. Among the gnarled trees in his front yard of his aged and neglected place, he maintains a strange collection of large stones, oddly grouped and painted so that they resemble the idols of some obscure Eastern temple. The collection frightens away most of the small boys who love to taunt the Terrible Old Man about his long white hair and beard, or to break into the small paned windows of his dwelling with wicked missiles. But there are other things which frighten the older and more curious folk, who sometimes steal up to the house to peer in through the dusty panes. These folk say that on a table in a large bare room on the ground floor are many peculiar bottles, in each a small piece of lead suspended pendulum-wise from a string. And they say that the Terrible Old Man talks to these bottles, addressing them by such names as Jack, Scarface, Long Tom, Spanish Joe, Peters, and Mate Ellis. And whenever he speaks to a bottle, the little lead pendulum within makes certain definite vibrations, as if in answer. Those who have watched the tall, lean, Terrible Old Man in these peculiar conversations do not watch him again. But Angelo Ricci and Joe Sasnack and Manuel Silva were not of Kingsport blood. They were of that new and heterogeneous alien stock which lies outside the charmed circle of New England life and traditions, and they saw in the Terrible Old Man merely a tottering, almost helpless graybeard, who could not walk without the aid of his knotted cane and whose thin, weak hand shook pitifully. They were really quite sorry in their way for the lonely, unpopular old fellow, whom everybody shunned, and at whom the dogs barked singularly. But business is business, and to a robber whose soul is in his profession, there is a lure and a challenge about a very old and very feeble man who has no account at the bank, and who pays for his few necessities at a village store with Spanish gold and silver minted 2 centuries ago. Messrs. Ricci, Sasnack, and Silva selected the night of April 11th for their call. Mr. Ricci and Mr. Silva were to interview the poor old gentleman, whilst Mr. Sasnack waited for them in their presumable metallic burden with a covered motor car on Ship Street by the gate in the tall rear wall of the host's grounds. Desire to avoid needless explanations in case of unexpected police intrusions prompted these plans for a quiet and unicentatious departure. As prearranged, the three adventurers started out separately in order to prevent any evil-minded suspicions afterwards. Messrs. Ricci and Silva met at Water Street by the old man's front gate, and although they did not like the way the moon shone down upon the painted stones through the budding branches of the gnarled trees, they had more important things to think about than mere idle superstition. They feared it might be unpleasant work making the terrible old man loquacious concerning his hoarded gold and silver, for aged sea captains are notably stubborn and perverse. Still, he was very old and very feeble, and there were two visitors. Messrs. Ricky and Silva were experienced in the art of making unwilling persons voluble, and the screams of a weak and exceptionally vulnerable man can be easily muffled. So they moved up to the one lighted window and heard the terrible old man talking childishly to his bottles with pendulums. Then they donned masks and knocked politely at the weather-stained oaken door. Waiting seemed very long to Mr. Sasnak as he fidgeted restlessly in the covered motor car by the terrible old man's gate on Ship Street. He was more than ordinarily tender-hearted, and he did not like the hideous screams he had heard in the ancient house just after the hour appointed for the deed. Had he not told his colleagues to be as gentle as possible with the pathetic old sea captain? Very nervously, he watched that narrow oaken gate on the high and ivy-clad stone wall. Frequently, he consulted his watch and wondered at the delay. Had the old man died before revealing where his treasure was hidden and the thorough search became necessary? Mr. Sasnak did not like to wait so long in the dark in such a place. Then he sensed a soft tread or tapping on the walk inside the gate, heard a gentle fumbling at the rusty latch, and saw the narrow, heavy door swing inward. And in the pallid glow of the single dim street lamp, he strained his eyes to see what his colleagues had brought out of that sinister house which loomed so close behind. But when he looked, he did not see what he had expected, for his colleagues were not there at all, but only the terrible old man, leaning quietly on his knotted cane and smiling hideously. Mr. Sasnak had never before noticed the color of that man's eyes. Now he saw that they were yellow. Little things make considerable excitement in little towns, which is the reason that Kingsport people talked all that spring and summer about the three unidentifiable bodies horribly slashed as with many cutlasses and horribly mangled as by the tread of many cruel boot heels which the tide washed in. And some people even spoke of things as trivial as the deserted motor car found on Ship Street, or certain especially inhuman cries, probably of a stray animal or migratory bird, heard in the night by wakeful citizens. But in this idle village gossip, the terrible old man took no interest at all. He was by nature reserved, and when one is aged and feeble, one's reserve is doubly strong. Besides, so ancient a sea captain must have witnessed scores of things much more stirring in the far-off days of his unremembered youth. The End of The Terrible Old Man by H.P. Lovecraft.
Hey, just so you know, this is KSOW 10.67 Low Power FM in Cottage Grove, Oregon. Real Rural Radio. Today's programming on KSOW is made possible, in part, through underwriting by FNT Art and Photo, located at 504 Main Street in downtown Cottage Grove. FNT Art and Photo provides the community with a wide range of art supplies, printing and photo expertise, full-sized art posters, and popular design books. The next story is an episode of Mysterious Traveler, and was originally aired on April the 9th of 1944. It's called Beware of Tomorrow.
A Mysterious Traveler.
This is the Mysterious Traveler, inviting you to join me on another journey into the realm of the strange and the terrifying. I hope you will enjoy the trip, and it will thrill you a little and chill you a little. So settle back, get a good grip on your nerve, and be comfortable, if you can. It is midnight, and an old automobile is driving along a narrow road through the woods. At a point where a second road, even narrower, crosses the first, the car stops.
Here you are, young fella. This is the professor's place.
Is it? All I can see is woods.
It's up that road, about 50 yards. Look sharp and you can see the light shining between them two trees.
Huh? Oh, yes, I see it now. Then I guess I get out here. Would you hand me my bag, Sheriff Ramsey?
Right. Here you are.
Thanks. And that's a dollar I owe you, right?
Yep, thank you. You know the professor, do you?
Yes. I was Professor Clark's laboratory assistant back in college 10 years ago.
Oh.
Why?
I was thinking maybe you could drop a hint to him.
A hint? What kind of a hint?
Well, that there's been some talk in town of running him and that man of his, that Barton, fell out of the county.
Running Professor Clark? Oh, you're not serious.
Yep. Of course, it's just talk. So far.
But what has anybody got against Professor Clark? There isn't a milder man in the world.
Well, maybe so, but folks has got wind of what happened at the state penitentiary over in Hillvale last year.
Sheriff, you're talking in riddles. What did happen?
The professor went over there when they hanged Richard, that hold-up killer.
Uh-huh.
And the warden gave the professor the murderer's brain. That's what happened.
Ooh, what of it? Professor Clark is a great authority on nerve and brain tissues. Maybe he wanted it for research purposes.
Yeah, I'm not saying he didn't. I'm just telling you how folks are talking. They think he's keeping that brain in a big glass jar and making it grow.
That's perfectly ridiculous.
Well, they don't think so. They got the notion that brain is big as a bull calf by now, and they're afraid someday it'll escape.
Sheriff, for a minute I was taking you seriously. A brain as big as a calf?
Oh, I'm not saying I ever believed it, but it'd be a good idea if the professor'd give folks a notion of what he's really doing in that laboratory of his, with that Barton fella to help him. Then maybe the talk would die down.
I understand. All right, Sheriff, I'll mention it to him.
Well, then I'll be getting on. Good night, young fella.
Good night, Sheriff.
Right up that road, about 50 yards. You can't miss it.
A few moments later, Dr. Richard Dale was knocking on the door of an old stone house, almost hidden among the trees. A frail, white-haired old man answered the door. An old man who could hardly speak in his joy as he gripped Richard Dale's hand. He led the way down a long hall to a great room where strange equipment took up almost every inch of space. Retorts and electric furnaces, generators, batteries, and great glass vats. Dr. Dale stared around him in intense curiosity as Professor Clark helped him off with his hat and coat.
There. Now, sit down, Dick, my boy. Sit down and let me get a good look at you. So, you got my letter? Yes, yes, of course you did, or you wouldn't be here.
Thanks, Professor. Yes, I got your letter. And it made me so curious I took the first train. You promised me a surprise. Well, is this it, this amazing laboratory?
No, no, my boy. I'll come to that in a moment after you've met Barton, my assistant.
Barton? I don't seem to know the name. Should I?
No, he's not famous yet. But he will be. He's been with me only a few months. I couldn't get along without him.
He certainly sounds interesting.
You'll like him, I'm sure you will. Barton?
Yes, Professor?
Dr. Dale has arrived. I want you to meet him.
Why, of course. How do you do, Dr. Dale? We both of us been looking forward to your visit.
How do you do? Yes, the professor's letter made me so curious I couldn't stay away. I'm still wondering what the great surprise is he promised me.
You'll see, Dick, in just a minute.
My curiosity's at fever pitch.
Well, it's time to satisfy it. Barton, is Alpha making some coffee?
Yes, he started it when we heard the car.
Alpha? Who is he?
Our general man of all work.
Truly amazing fellow. Here he comes now.
Shall Alpha serve coffee?
Good heavens.
I said you'd be surprised, Dick.
He's not human. He's a machine. A robot.
Yes, my boy. An artificial man made from metal and synthetic brain tissue.
A machine man. But walking and talking.
He's not very pretty, but then the professor was mostly interested in making sure he'd work.
He must weigh a ton.
No, only about 300 pounds. You see, Alpha's mostly aluminum and other light alloys. Inside his aluminum plates are some new batteries I devised, together with miles of fine silver wire and a dozen electric motors. And to give you only the highlights...
It's a good thing you did keep this for a surprise. If you had mentioned it in your letter, I don't think I would have believed you.
Shall Alpha serve coffee now?
Yes, Alpha. Put it on this table here, and pour a cup for Dr. Dale.
Alpha, do so.
Still can't make myself believe it.
Alpha poured coffee.
Go on, Dick. Take it.
Huh? Oh, yes, of course. Al, thank you.
Alpha, this is Dr. Dale, our guest. Any orders he gives are to be obeyed.
Alpha understands.
He looks clumsy, but he poured the coffee as well as a man could.
Yes, my boy, Alpha has capabilities you'd never suspect to look at him. Here, I'll show you. Alpha.
Alpha hears.
The fireplace needs more wood. Put on that big log there.
Alpha, do it. Alpha has log.
Now, break it in half.
Alpha, break it.
Six log. He's breaking it with his hand.
Good. We won't need you anymore tonight, Alpha.
You can go back to your room now.
Alpha is going.
Be sure to switch off your batteries. They're going to need recharging tomorrow.
Alpha understands.
That's the most incredible thing I ever saw.
You see, Dick, I try to treat Alpha as if he were really a man. So I give him a room of his own. Like any machine, he's completely inactive when his batteries have been switched off. But his brain continues to function. It's an artificial protoplasm that I spent 8 years creating. It's the only thing that makes him different from any other machine.
But it means Alpha can think. Think like a man.
A machine that can walk and talk and think.
Ah, but Alpha's not the only surprise I have for you, Dick.
He's not?
No, I have another one. Even more astonishing. But you'll have to wait until morning to learn about that. Because now it's time we were both in bed.
I suppose you're right. It's after one.
I know you must be tired. I'm getting old. So I'm going up to bed now, Dick. Barton will show you to your room.
Of course, Professor. I'll see you in the morning, then.
Yes. We'll have a long talk tomorrow. Good night.
Good night, Professor Clark.
Oh, Dr. Dale.
Yes, Barton?
Could we talk for a minute before I show you to your room?
Oh, yes, of course.
It occurs to me the professor forgot to tell you why he asked you here.
Why, yes, that's true. And I've been so interested I forgot to ask.
It was his hope that you'd stay indefinitely and help us carry forward the work we've been doing here.
Stay indefinitely? Well, I have my own work.
Don't say no yet. Now, just think, Dr. Dale... Alpha is stronger and more rugged than a man. He needs no rest, no food. Yet he can do the work of three men. He can plow, reap, run machinery. Think how much drudgery a million like him could lift from mankind's shoulders.
Yes, that's true.
And already Alpha is technically obsolete. Professor Clark has the blueprint for a new machine man. As superior to Alpha as an airplane is to a bicycle. We want you to help us build them.
Well, I'm certainly tempted. Perhaps I could arrange.
Ah, excellent. And now there's only one more thing I want to tell you.
Yes? What is it?
It's about Alpha. You must help me persuade the professor to dismantle him.
Dismantle him? Why?
He has become dangerous.
I don't understand.
Because he was the first successful machine man that the professor built. He is imperfect in many ways. He's not completely reliable. I'm afraid that someday he may escape from the house and so do some damage that would seriously upset our plans.
Yes, yes, that could easily happen.
The local inhabitants are unfriendly enough as it is.
I know. Sheriff Ramsey was warning me about that tonight. All right, I'll speak to Professor Clark about it tomorrow.
Ah, good. Then I'll show you to your room now, if you wish.
Yes. I am sleepy.
If you'll just come this way.
His mind in a whirl of amazement, Dr. Dale retired and finally fell into an uneasy sleep. How long he had slept, he did not know. When abruptly he woke with a scream ringing in his ears.
Help! Dick! Help! Please!
The cry came from downstairs. Dr. Dale leaped from his bed and raced down to the lower floor.
Dick! Help! Help me!
In the lower hall, he found Barton hammering on the heavy door of the laboratory.
Professor Clark! Professor Clark, what's wrong?
What's up?
It's the professor. I heard him call for help.
Huh. Yes, so did I. It woke me up.
The door's locked. He must be in there, but there's no sound in there now.
Well, we've got to break the door down.
Yes. Put your shoulder beside mine.
Right. You ready?
Ready.
And shut. Professor Clark, where are you?
Professor Clark, he's not here.
Yes. Here he is, lying on the floor beside the window.
He's been murdered.
It was Alpha. It must have been. No one else could have done it.
Where is Al?
The window. It's open. He went out that day.
We've got to go after him.
I'm afraid it's hopeless. At night in these woods, we couldn't possibly find him.
No, you're right.
It'll be morning soon. Then I think he'll come back. He knows that he can only go a few more hours before his batteries must be recharged.
Then we can capture him and destroy him. But, Barton, why did he kill the man who created him?
The professor must have come down to the laboratory for some reason. Occasionally, when he couldn't sleep, he would do that. He may have decided to make some more tests of Alpha.
Yes, but that doesn't explain why...
During the test, something must have occurred. When Alpha returns, we can find out.
Poor Professor Clark. Well, we'll have to notify the police.
There's only the sheriff. In any case, I think we should wait till morning and then report the professor's death as an accident.
An accident?
Yes. If the authorities learn the truth, our research may be stopped. And when Professor Clark has achieved so much, can we let it go for nothing?
No, of course not.
Dr. Dale, we must carry on his work for him.
Yes, that's what he would want.
Then you will help me continue it? You'll stay?
Yes. Yes, I'll stay.
Greatly upset by the tragedy, Dr. Dale returned to bed. At last, fell into an uneasy sleep, haunted by dreams of Alpha, the metal monster Professor Clark had created. When he awoke, the sun was shining, and he could hear Barton moving about downstairs. He dressed and went down to find Barton getting breakfast ready.
Oh, good morning, Dr. Dale.
Good morning, Barton. Any sign of Alpha?
Not yet.
Well, we ought to start a search for him.
But first, I think you ought to eat breakfast. Everything's ready.
All right. Some coffee anyway.
Yes. Sit here.
Thank you. I didn't know you were a cook as well as a lab assistant, Barton.
I've learned to do a lot of things since I came here.
Aren't you going to eat, too?
I'm not hungry. I seldom am. But I thought that while you ate, I might outline some of the problems facing us.
That's a good idea.
You see, though Alpha's brain is of synthetic protoplasm, it is not completely artificial.
I was wondering about that. Sheriff Ramsey mentioned that the professor secured a human brain from...
From an executed killer, yes. The professor found that to give life to his artificial brain tissue, it was necessary to add a small amount of tissue from a real brain.
I see. If the real tissue gave life to the rest. Of course.
Yes, but in this instance, it may have tainted Alpha's brain with the murderous impulse of a killer.
Yes, that sounds plausible.
So our first problem will be to obtain untainted brain tissues to blend with the artificial tissues we will make according to the professor's formula.
That should give us no trouble. I can get what we need through the research laboratories where I'm connected.
Ah, then that solves our worst problem. The rest will be matters of detail. Fortunately, there's enough equipment here to build a dozen or so robots.
Like Alpha, you mean?
No. The far more advanced type Professor Clark was perfecting. And now, if you've finished, I have something to show you.
Yes, I'm through. I don't feel much like eating after last night.
Then come with me to the laboratory, and I'll show you the second surprise that Professor Clark had in store for you. Here we are. What I'm going to show you is in this box.
Another robot?
Yes. A second mechanical man the professor built a few months ago. This one, though, was a failure.
You mean it wouldn't work?
It worked too well.
I don't follow.
It was too intelligent. Professor Clark called it Beta. And Beta's brain power was greater than that of any human scientist who ever lived. But Beta was insane.
Good Lord.
He represented, however, a tremendous technical advance. Look.
It looks exactly like a human being.
Yes. Professor Clark used me for a model when he built Beta.
It's an excellent likeness.
Touch the face, Doctor.
All right. Feels smooth and rubbery with a hard surface underneath.
The surface is a new plastic Professor Clark developed with which he could imitate exactly the appearance of human skin. Underneath is an aluminum body on which the plastic was baked.
I see.
Beta's hair, eyes, and teeth are all artificial, too. But he walked and talked and acted so much like a human being that no man alive could have guessed his secret.
No, he would have fooled me completely. And you say he was insane?
From the human viewpoint, yes. He considered himself superior to the human race. With his enormous brain power, he intended to make himself ruler of the world.
You were joking.
Not in the least. That is why Professor Clark destroyed him just in time. He had made plans to take over this laboratory and construct dozens of mechanical men like himself. And then, with their help, he was going to enslave all mankind.
Barton, if that could happen once, it might happen again. I don't believe we should continue Professor Clark's work after all.
Oh, there's no danger now, Doctor. You see, Beta also had a brain which contained tissues taken from that of the condemned murderer, but we will select the brain tissues from the highest types that are available.
Yes, but even so,
then,
you...
Doctor, we will produce mechanical men, tireless, indestructible, who will be mankind's willing servants, who will solve for man problems he can't solve for himself.
I wonder. In any case, we must proceed with the utmost caution.
Of course. Doctor, listen.
Someone's come into the house.
It's Alpha. He's come back.
Alpha, we may need a weapon, Bart.
No, I can control him. Alpha. Alpha, come here.
Alpha, come.
Alpha, you killed Professor Clark. Why did you do it?
Professor said he would destroy Alpha.
And you killed him because of that?
Alpha does not want to be destroyed.
But you're just a machine. What difference does it make to you?
Alpha is machine that lives. Alpha is stronger than you. Alpha is better than you.
Alpha, be quiet.
We must destroy Alpha at once.
You are right, Doctor. Do you hear, Alpha? You are to be punished.
Alpha here.
But first, we want to know where you've been. Did anyone see you?
Men saw Alpha.
Men saw you? What do you mean?
Two men driving automobiles saw him.
And what did they do?
They tried to hit Alpha with automobile.
And then what happened?
Alpha stopped automobile. Alpha killed one man.
Killed him?
Other man ran off in woods. Alpha could not find him. Alpha came back.
We can't keep this a secret. No matter what happens, we must notify the authorities at once.
No, wait, let me think. We can't...
The bell, there's someone at the door.
I'll see who it is. You stay here.
But what about Alpha?
I'll switch off his batteries, then he can't move. There. Now I'll see who's at the door.
Dr. Dale waited while Barton went to the door. He heard the door open and recognized the excited voice of Sheriff Ramsey speaking. Then a moment later, Barton came back into the laboratory, followed by the sheriff, who held a revolver in his hand.
But, Sheriff, if you'd only let me explain...
Never mind that. You're coming with me, both of you.
Dr. Dale, perhaps you can reason with the sheriff. He insists that we're under arrest.
Yes, and I'm taking you to the lockup. The professor, too. Where is he?
Professor Clark is dead, Sheriff.
Dead?
He was killed last night when an experiment he was engaged in went wrong.
An experiment, huh? I suppose it was an experiment that crushed the life out of him. It crushed the life out of Jed Thompson an hour ago down the road and scared Fred Jennings so bad all he can do is jabber about monsters.
It's true. The things that killed both the professor and Thompson is an experiment. It's standing there behind...
A machine. A man made out of machinery.
Oh, don't be alarmed, Sheriff. It's perfectly harmless now. It is a machine man which Professor Clark built. Unfortunately, it got out of control.
I don't believe it.
I don't blame you, Sheriff, but that's the truth. I think I can convince you.
What are you doing? Stand still.
I'm simply going to switch Alpha on. There. Now he can move and speak as well as you and me.
That thing talk? You're lying. You're up to something.
Alpha, will you tell the sheriff that it was you who killed Mr. Thompson?
Alpha killed him. He tried to hit Alpha with car.
That's what the professor was up to all this time. Building that thing.
Now, Sheriff, surely you realize that we are not murderers.
Maybe not, but you'll come to jail just the same. You're partly responsible anyhow.
But, Sheriff...
Anyway, for your own protection, there's a mob on its way out here from town. They're going to burn this place down. Oh. I got to put you in jail for your own safety. They're ready to lynch you right now.
Burn the place down?
That's what I said. So turn that machine thing off and come along. We ain't got much time.
No. All this equipment, machinery, the professor's notes, they must not be destroyed. We must stop them.
Yes, Sheriff. The loss of science...
Never mind science. You got your own skins to worry about. That mob means business. Let's get started.
I'm afraid we can't do that, Sheriff.
You can't. I got a six-shooter here that says different.
We have no choice, Barton.
Oh, yes, we have. Alpha, take the gun away from this man.
What are you doing? Stop him! Stop him, Moran!
Too late, Dr. Dale. He's dead.
Alpha crushed him?
Yes, Dr. Dale.
Now, you're a murderer.
In a good cause. The life of one man or of a dozen men cannot stand in my way.
You don't expect me to keep silent about this, do you?
I think you will. Alpha. Alpha!
He doesn't answer.
His batteries have gone dead. That last burst of energy must have drained them dry. But it makes no difference.
I think it does. A big difference! There, see this? It's Sheriff Ramsey's revolver with three bullets still in it. Now put your hands up.
I must explain something to you, Doctor.
You can talk, but if you move, I'll shoot.
I only want to say that nothing is going to interfere with my plan to build more of the improved form of robots that Professor Clark perfected before his death. Robots who look and act so much like men, no one can detect them.
They'll never be built. I intend to destroy all of Professor Clark's notes.
They will be built by me. I shall build 10, 100, 1,000... Then I shall lead them with a superior intelligence to the mastery of the world.
You're mad. Of course I should have
guessed. No, Doctor, that's not the answer. I shall tell you the truth. And then you must die.
Stand still or I'll shoot.
You remember last night when the professor said he had another surprise for you? An even greater surprise than Alpha?
Yes.
That surprise, Doctor, was Beta, the second robot. So perfect it looked like a man. But so intelligent that human beings were children in comparison.
But Beta was destroyed.
No, Dr. Beta was not destroyed. But you must be destroyed.
Stand back. Stand back, I say. All right, then I'll shoot.
And now, Doctor, your bullets are gone.
You aren't even hurt.
Bullets cannot harm me. That's what I'm trying to tell you. Beta, the second robot, was not destroyed.
But I saw him.
What you saw was only an initial attempt that failed. The real Beta still exists. You see, Dr. Dale, I am Beta.
You?
Yes. I, too, am a mechanical man. And now, you must die.
No. No, stay away from me. Stay away!
This is the mysterious traveler again. What happened to Dr. Dale? Why, he's still alive, but of course under observation in a hospital. In fact, it was he who told me the story. You see, the mob that was coming to burn down the house arrived just in time to save him. A Barton, or Beta as he called himself, escaped. He could hardly have survived all those bullets if he had been human, could he? But I wonder if the story is true.
Do you suppose that somewhere a strange individual who is really a robot is making other mechanical men, preparing to carry out Barton's plan to rule the world? Oh, you haven't time to talk about it now. You're getting off here. Well, I'm sorry. But perhaps we'll meet again soon. I take this same train every week at this same time.
You just heard Chapter 19 of The Mysterious Traveler, a series of dramas of the strange and terrifying brought to you each week by Station WOR. In tonight's story, Beware of Tomorrow, Will Hare played Dr. Dale and Don Randolph played Barton. Also featured were Maurice Tarplin and Philip Clark. The Mysterious Traveler, written by Bob Arthur and David Cogan, is directed by Jock McGregor. Original music was played by Doc Whipple. The Mysterious Traveler is presented over WOR Mutual every Sunday at 7 over most of these stations. This is Mutual.
Okay, that was, well, you know what that was. What you're interested in, if you're interested in anything, is what's next. And next, I have one more import from the UK for you. It's a program called The Price of Fear. This show was produced by the BBC in the 1970s and featured Vincent Price as the host and narrator. Now, in tonight's episode, Blind Man's Bluff, Price relates the story as if it were something that had actually happened to him. I'm not really going to go into any detail now. I mean, you'll be able to hear it in just a moment if I ever shut up. I do want to sound a note of caution here. This story will require a little bit of effort on your part to follow because of the slightly odd cadence of the old blind man's speech, and he does have an accent. But this is a very effective little story, and I think it's well worth your time to listen to it.
Price of Fear, brought to you by Vincent Price.
Yes, I remember Adelstrop, the name, because one afternoon of heat, the express train drew up there unwantedly. Hello, welcome. That poem by Edward Thomas will, I feel sure, be familiar to some of you. But for myself, well, let's say it evokes a very particular occasion. A story so bizarre and so horrendous, I still find it difficult to decide whether it actually happened or not. I've called it Blind Man's Bluff. But to begin at the beginning, then. I was on my way to visit some friends in a remote part of the West Country. The train was certainly no express, but we were jogging along quite nicely through the lovely Cornish countryside when suddenly we braked and stopped. An unscheduled stop at, no, hardly a station even, at its best a country halt, so insignificant that it was not even considered worthy of a name board. The window was already lowered to its full. I looked out on a single small shack, which obviously served as ticket and parcel office combined. But no activity there, or for that matter, anywhere else. Discarded and rusting milk churns, a mongrel dog panting in the sun, the drone of bees, and far off over the fields, a glimpse of a church tower. But no life. No apparent reason for what seemed a simply endless delay. Until, at the very moment when I'd all but decided to investigate the reason, we began to pull away. It was then I saw him.
Wait, Thursday! In the name of God, wait!
A man rushing through the entrance along the platform towards the now fast-moving train, rushing so heedlessly that it seemed he actually intended to throw himself under the very wheel.
Wait, have you, wait!
Instinctively and probably against my better judgment, I opened the compartment door, called out, offered a hand, and finally managed to haul him aboard. But it wasn't until I'd subsided into my seat directly opposite my rescued companion that I realized how truly foolhardy we had both been. The man was blind, quite blind.
Kind of you. Truly kind. To risk yourself like that. Truly kind.
Oh, no. The least I could do. Anyone would have done the same.
They wouldn't. Dig for me, they wouldn't. What? Not anyone. Not most later. Most would have stood and watched. Maybe even hope for the worst. What? How about that?
The worst were you surely not suggesting.
Miss put in the sudden top of a screeching of brakes, and then they all climbed out to see. My God, to fill their putrid eyeballs. By God, the thing under the wheels, by God. I know, you see. By God, how I know.
His knuckles were white about the stick. Gnarled white knuckles about the white peeling paint of his blind man's stick. He wore a long, old-fashioned raincoat, reached quite down to his ankles. In spite of the stifling heat, he buttoned it up tight around his throat, and a black beret pulled down almost to his eyebrows. But most of all, the spectacles, so deep and black, they seemed like the sockets of the dead, fathomless, with only the reflection of my own curiosity staring back at me, my own reflection, and the sudden and uncomfortable conviction that I was being watched, and assessed, inexorably assessed.
Oh, don't think I don't know why they wish it. I know fine why, all right.
I beg your pardon, my dear.
Misfortune, calamity. It gives them this feeling of power, you see. It gives them the feeling of being one up all the time, of being superior all the time.
Oh, but surely the majority of us must be allowed some feeling of compassion.
Compassion, he says.
Well, I certainly never intended to suggest that we're all alike.
And foolish to presume. Still, you did offer a helping hand at risk of life and limb, I'll grant you that. But smoke, then, if you must.
Why?
Well, are you damn well going to light up, aren't you?
How did you know that I wanted a cigarette?
Perception. Here's a toffee nose word for you, innit? But bang on target, all right.
Yeah.
You're done with it, then.
Oh, thanks.
Perception. It's the gift God gives us specials, you see, to make up for the things he's taken away. God. Or the devil. Or whatever.
Will you smoke too?
No. There's no good looking put out. Never could abide the damn thing.
Well, look, if you'd rather, I did.
Did I didn't say that, did I? Suggested it in the first place, didn't I?
Yeah.
Kind of you to ask. Kind of you to offer. Perception. No sight. Nah. Never have done.
Oh, I am sorry.
But smell, touch. Read your mind like a book and no mistake. So don't ever get round to thinking different. No, I'm sorry for that. Not wanting to say that, just by way of protecting myself, you see.
Sure.
Hard times don't help, of course. But most. On account of him.
Of him?
Boy Con. Con me name. con be nature. Never told him to his face, of course. It would have been the end of me to tell it to his face.
The blind man's knuckles tightened about the handle of his stick again. But a sudden tautness about the shoulders, too, a feeling of violence so suppressed, so pent, I hesitated to ask the next question, but there was no need. Again, he anticipated me.
You like a look. But I told you that once already, and I...
Yes, yes, yes.
Calm. No, think about it anymore. Not a thing to be thought about, you see.
Your friend, then?
No, no, no. No friend. Never a friend. Time passing and all begins to wonder if he wasn't sent.
Hmm?
A means, maybe. A means of getting me own back.
Revenge?
People? World? The way it was decided for me. Happy once. Before, Con. Mother. Home. Just a small farm worker's cottage. Only home I'd ever known. Familiar to me, see. Familiar. Familiar as the back of this hand. Important, that. Knowing it's every corner, every stair. The way every stick of furniture was arranged and her never changing anything around. Give you a feeling of security I could not found nowhere else. She gave me that. My mother gave me that.
I can see what it must have meant to you.
You can see. She paid for it, mine. Worked up at the big house, not the mansion exactly, but in the way she described it as me, yours makes no difference. Hard work. Bad pay, long hours. Again, ruddy power of the strong or the weak in it. But at least the stinking pittance they allowed kept the thatch over our heads. A sacrifice I was glad to make. Never did get over her death. Bad enough sitting by the side of the bed and watching somebody die. But when all you got to go by is the feel, the pulse, the listen to their breathing. Hard, that.
Well, what did you do after?
First off, seemed no answer. Bit she'd managed to say, put on the side, well, soon gone. And then one day, I gets this idea. Almost as though her'd meant me to get it. Not a damn sound when it seemed at the time.
Oh?
Well, this is still their old room standing empty, isn't there?
Oh, yes, a lodger, you mean.
And why not, I think. Still plenty of harvest labor being taken on up at the estate. All crying out for a place to lay their heads. And me, with no barn left neither. A fair share of home comforts besides. So I puts this card stuck up in the post office window tonight, and I waits. I waits. But not for too long. Convoy sort of that.
Home from home, as a ruddy gould to call it.
This was my mother's room.
Yeah, we still don't make it a suite at the Waldorf, do we? Dear junk. You never see such junk.
Please, be careful.
Oh, not to worry. Can always have it written in the lease, can't we? Some kind of inventory? Hmm? Did you ever get round to your actual inventory, Pops? Oh, dear, oh, dear. Oh, well, there's one little item we won't have to be worrying our heads about.
Please,
In the name of God, let's have this window open. The old ruddy place sticks and mothballs.
Oh. You could make some changes. The room would be yours, so you've been entitled to make some changes.
Yeah, there'll be some changes, all right.
Have you... Think the rent too high, we could discuss.
Don't let me asking price can wait. There would be changes, yes. Changes, all right.
I see.
Well, love of God. You didn't honestly think I'd be moving in and just taking your old lady's place, did you? Jigglypox? Taking over the nurse companion bit just where she left off.
Oh.
If it's the white stick and Alsatian dog kick you're after, you should have tried getting it straight from the start.
As far as my handicap goes.
Well, then?
I think I'm self-sufficient.
Oh, sure you are. I noticed that. The way you groped yourself across that landing just now.
It's been some time since me mother's death. Some time.
How about the way you tumbled across that chair the minute we get through the door? Just a touch of the old circus act for my benefit, I suppose.
When she was ill, there was this nurse. Her rearranged some of the furniture in view of the special circumstances, you understand.
Yeah, I understand, Cops. The $64 question is, do you?
Sorry.
Dumb as well as blind, eh? Well, I'm asking you, Pops, if you finally got round to persuading me to move into this rat-ridden garret, do you honestly know what you'd be letting yourself in for? Pot luck at the best and at the worst.
You're making it sound like some kind of threat.
Change, Pops. But then it all comes down to that, in the end.
But you still agreed to take him?
Not at first. But the weeks passed. There were no other offers.
Oh.
They took the card from the post office window. The people up at the big house were getting pressing. Threats, eviction, legal action. Only roots I had, you see. No choice.
So Khan moved in?
Oh, he moved in all right.
Yeah, and...
I did me best for him. Mm. At first, I was even glad, just for the sound of another voice about the place. Well, natural, isn't it?
Sure.
The past can be good, but it's funny how eager we all are just to be alive in the present. Any kind of present.
And it didn't work out then, huh?
He took over. Completely. Not just his own room. Completely. His friends from the estate, up drinking all the hours God made. No notion about paying the rent. And then, early one morning...
Yeah.
My mother's things. Clothes, photographs, the bric-a-brac of a lifetime, really. A pathetic pyre at the bottom of the garden.
You ruddy rot stink, Pops. That's all you got going here. Well then, not blind as a rotten mole, maybe, but can't you smell the stench of her, eh? Enough to drive the starlings off the trees, innit? Innit, though, eh? Stink and pus and a maggot-ridden old bit of garbage. That's all we've got here.
You no right, Con.
No right? Whose bleeding nostrils have they been getting up every hour of the day and night, eh? Space to expand, you see, Pops. That's what Con needs. I'm never going to get it with this ragbag of mildew cluttering up the place now, was he?
You could have asked.
Oh, go on. So it's asking terms we're after now, is it? Yes, sir, no, sir. Three bags full, sir, now, is it?
If you just asked first, I could have moved them, couldn't I? Somewhere out of your way.
So look at it this way, my dear old mate. Convoy's saving you all that extra trouble, isn't he, eh? I'll tell you something funny, though. A couple of weeks back, I damn well goes putting myself out trying to sell the stuff.
You tried to sell my mother's...
Well, of course. That shark of a scrap dealer the other side of the village.
You had no right.
Oh, back to rights again, are we?
None!
Now, go easy, Molly. Oh, unless you'd like to join the pyre, that is. Right, old scarecrow, you make of it. Fancy your Guy Fawkes a bit early then this year, eh, Pops?
They were hers, damn you.
So now they're hers again, ain't they? Ashes to ashes, all that garbage, eh? You should be hanging out the flags, Molly. Really, you should. Doing you a favour, Convoy is. I mean, to say better than settling for a feast day for them moths now, ain't it? And what about them tarty little cherubs up there, ruddy green with envy when Mumsy gets all these nice new drags for the post, eh?
Why, Convoy?
Kicks. Pleasure. Yeah. You haven't got a clue in there what I'm getting at, have you? Something you're never going to get round to, Molly. Oh, like tonight, for instance, me and my mates regular old booze up my place, Pops, round about 8. Make yourself a bit scarcish, hmm? You will do that, won't you, Mowley, with Con doing the asking? Always depend on blind old Mowley when it's Con doing the asking. Oh, the fire's nearly out. Nothing left to save. Oh, you could always try spitting into the wind.
And yet you did nothing.
I could have gone to the police. Should have gone to the police. I see that now. But when you... independent on the strength and decisions of others for a whole lifetime, there comes a time when you need so desperately to feel the power of self-assertion, the ability to act. I found a thing to do. Winter was coming. The cottage was fitted for gas. I just got Con a gas fire over his bedroom. Very sensitive to cold was Con. It burned all hours of the day and night, and sometimes he even let it burn while he slept.
So?
One night, I simply turned it off.
Oh, you mean you went into his room and turned it off?
Oh, no, no, the mains of the downstairs mains.
Well, then?
But
well,
then... when the flames had been extinguished, I turned it on again. I blanketed the crack beneath his door.
Uh-huh.
Stood there a long time, listening to the hiss of the gas that escaped into the room. Con's sleep, in his drunken stupor, become deeper, ever deeper. Till I decided he did add enough, sufficient to be purpose.
You mean you gassed him? You murdered him?
Well, that would have been a kind of revenge, but too simple. I hated him. But there's a need beyond hate. He was quite unconscious when I went into him, as deep unconscious as if he were under anesthetic. Now, underneath the cottage... we had a cellar. In the old times, it had been used for storing apples, vegetables. And now it was quite empty. The only entrance was through a trap door set into the flags of the kitchen floor, but long, long in by a big chest used for storing firewood. And I pulled the chest aside. Open the trap. Lord. Body. Ada. The dank smell of damp. The scurry of a rat.
And you left him there.
Well, not at once. No, one more thing to do, you see. To give him a taste of the affliction he mocked and made fun of over all these long months. I returned to me mother's neat front parlor. Her old work basket was always on a small window table just where I'd left it. A long steel bodkin. The stout thread just right. And I returned to the cellar. There. In the eternal dark, I sewed up his eyes, stitch by stitch, neatly, methodically, upper lid to lower. I sewed up his eyes, and then I left him there.
What happened when the effects of the gas wore off?
Oh, it allowed for that. It was to be the final irony. My final irony.
Where am I?
my room. What light? Light, damn you, but light. There's no light. It's all dark. What eyes? I produce you. Eyes. Tight, closed, stuck. Tight. Nothing. Sewn up.
Final irony, my final triumph. In the deep, dank dark, he'd search the door, he'd search unseen, screaming with the searing pain of his sewed-up eyes, groping, panicking round the damp, lichen-covered walls, searching, ever searching the door that would let him out. Out to the light, to the help he'd always taken for granted.
Not knowing, not comprehending that there was no door.
But the only way out was not in the walls, but through the trapdoor, not 3 feet above his head. A trapdoor, securely bolted, but weighed down by the heavy oak chest. I left that night. Yeah, I never went back.
They'd be bound to miss him. I mean, up at the estate.
Over a few days they'd miss him, but he was only a traveling casual labor. They come and went at will. For a few days they'd miss him, then they'd forget. He was only worth forgetting.
The train had stopped at a small halt. The blind man pulled himself to his feet. I opened the door and helped him down onto the deserted platform. For a single brief moment he seemed to study me, and then he raised the opaque blackness of his glasses, and there seemed to be a smile. In the milk-white, clouded eyes, the ghost of a smile. Then he turned and pulled that dirty raincoat even closer about him and tapped his way towards the exit. The tap-tap of his stick mingling with the birdsong. We pulled away into that green, bright world of trees and fields beyond.
Well, okay, it's around about midnight now, and that means I'm going to go home. Now, if you don't have anything else to do next Sunday, I mean, nothing better, well, I'll be here on the radio, and I'll have more old radio shows. Well, why don't you come back? Good night, all. This is Gary Clinton. And finally, this is Rhapsody in Blue.